So today's one solo lesson is, did God allow polygamy in the Old Testament? Which might seem a bit of an unusual topic, but Pastor did mention about polygamy going to be the next sexual sin that's on the rise, and I had already heard a couple of things that had been had me already thinking about that topic, particularly about the Old Testament. There are those who think that polygamy was allowed in the Old Testament. Once I heard a Christian broadcaster use that as an explanation of why King David had multiple wives. A viewer had sent in a question, and he was explaining that was allowed back then. He also explained the science of it by explaining that a man could father many children this way to help populate the earth. How this is supposed to work when women were about 50% of the population wasn't thought of. But I even heard a conservative Christian say that was allowed in Old Testament times, but later in another recording, he seemed to have corrected his thinking. So this is, a real belief. People actually do believe that the Old Testament allowed polygamy. The New Testament is pretty clear on this. At least it's pretty clear until politics say that it's not clear, and that doesn't mean what it says. 1 Timothy 3:2. A bishop then must be blameless. The husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach. Now, some people might say, well, being a Christian, you don't necessarily have to be apt to teach. This is talking about bishops. But also note that a bishop must first be blameless. And the very next thing that lists after that is the husband of one wife. Whereas apt to teach is actually at the end of that thing. And I could argue that even a Christian should be apt to teach, if only by example. And no one would argue that a Christian shouldn't be vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality. So, since apt to teach is put at the end, it suggests that Christians are supposed to be husband of one wife. And in 1 Timothy 3, did I accidentally overshoot? Yep, I overshot. Sorry, I was worried about this. Okay, let's see. Yes, 1 Timothy 3:12. Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own house as well. And Titus 1:6. If any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. Now, all these are definitely focusing on church offices, but the fact that this is the, major part of the standard in a time with plenty of polygamy, so that's supposed to be our standard too. And I think most people would agree that the New Testament teaches this. In part, probably because there aren't as many examples of polygamy during the New Testament. And again, it's like, if any be blameless. Again, in the next thing on the list, it's the husband of one wife. So if we're under New Testament command, why study an Old Testament rule? Well, first, it's in the Bible. We're kind of supposed to study things in the Bible. But the second thing is we need to know whether this is a rule change from the Old Testament to the New Testament, or if it's always been a rule. If this is a rule change, we need to know how to defend God as consistent and good. We can do that with the ceremonial sacrifices, because it changed from doing that to just accepting Jesus as the Savior. But the reason is those sacrifices were pointing to Jesus. And so we understand the consistency of the rule. And if it's always been a rule, then we need to know how to defend that position. Now, are there examples of polygamy in the Old Testament? And the answer is yes. There's lots of examples of polygamy in the Old Testament. There are also examples of ignorance of Scripture. Lying, slavery, murder, lost tempers, hypocrisy, drunkenness, and running from God. Examples aren't permissions. There are laws governing polygamy in the Old Testament. You can also find laws about slavery and divorce. And let's look at what Jesus said about the Old Testament and divorce. Mark 10, 2 through 9. And the Pharisees came to him and asked him, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife?" tempting him. And he answered and said unto them, "What did Moses command you?" And they said, "Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away." And Jesus answered and said unto them, "For the hardness of your heart he wrote you this precept. But from the beginning of the creation God made them male and female. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So then they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." For the hardness of your heart. So Moses wrote a rule about how to conduct divorce. Not because he approved of divorce or that divorce was even something that was considered good. But if they were going to do something bad, this is the way you do it. You don't just dump a woman. You at least give her some piece of paper, you know, explain why she's off on her own. There are also rules about slavery, probably also to mitigate the evils of it. They're often called them servants instead of slaves. Now, I admit I don't understand all the regulations, but some of them are pretty plain. Stealing a man, i.e. kidnapping, had the death penalty. You find that in Exodus 21:16, Deuteronomy 24:7. And then, you aren't allowed to turn in a runaway slave. Deuteronomy 23:15-16. So, if you didn't treat your slave well and they ran away, you couldn't get any help getting him back. Certain of the slaves were set free on set years and given resources on the way out. Deuteronomy 15:12-15. And I emphasize set years. They couldn't try to figure out some way to finagle it and extend the slavery. It was on a set year. All these laws were violated with U.S. slavery. We kidnapped, or we paid someone who kidnapped runaway slaves. They go to a free state. They had to be turned in. And certainly, you aren't required to free your slaves. You were allowed to free your slaves. That was an improvement over the British system. But you weren't allowed, you weren't forced to. So again, we see that laws governing slavery, all of them suggest that slavery is not really a good thing. Although their version was much better than ours. So the question is, are the Old Testament rules trying to reduce the effects of a prevalent evil instead of giving permission? Let's see here. And to determine that, we're going to look at what the Old Testament said no to. Deuteronomy 17, 15 through 17. Now, a lot of this is not about the topic on hand, but I'm reading it for context. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren thou shalt set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. So we have right there, the king shall not multiply wives to himself. Which answered that Christian broadcaster right there. It was forbidden. And we look and we see what happens. King David had plenty of family drama. This sermon series, as Pastor's been taking us through 2 Samuel, is really showing that. And we haven't gotten to them yet, but it includes succession questions. And then, of course, there's Solomon, whose heart was led from God by his hundreds of wives. And so we have this rule in these examples of what goes wrong with polygamy. But we also have Leviticus 18:18. Neither shalt thou take a wife to her sister to vex her, to uncover her nakedness beside the other in her lifetime. Remind you of Jacob's wives? And I would like to point out as we're going through Jacob's wives is that our longest, most concentrated example of polygamy are Jacob's wives, where we really see the results. So we have Leah and we have Rachel. Rachel was loved, Leah less loved. And if you read through this story, Genesis 29, 32, through chapter 30, verse 24, Leah and Rachel were in competition. They competed by having children, even through having their handmaids have children. So when Rachel wasn't having children, but Leah was, Rachel had her handmaid go to Jacob to get children that way. And then when Leah had temporarily left off bearing, she did the same with her handmaid. Eventually, of course, Leah had more children, and Rachel had her own biological children. But just the fact that this competition was happening. And you look at within those verses, Genesis 30, 14 through 16 in particular, Leah once rented a night with Jacob from Rachel. I mean, there's nothing about this relationship that says healthy or that was happy. And then later on in Genesis 33, 1 through 3, when heading to a potentially dangerous meeting with Esau, Jacob went first, which, that was his duty. He should go first, be the one most in danger. But then the handmaids and their kids, then Leah and hers, with Rachel and her Joseph furthest from danger. Benjamin was not yet born at that point. I mean, this is clear favoritism, and I would emphasize the Joseph part. Later, when Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery, it's pretty clear that there's the favoritism going on. There's the coat of many colors, and Joseph once giving a bad report about his brothers, that, all kinds of jealousy things, but it was going on as far back as then. Basically the others were told that their lives were less valuable. And it ties directly in with that. And then we look at four of Leah's sons. Now, Leah had six sons and a daughter, but we're going to look at the names of four of them. There's Reuben, whose name means behold a son. Surely the Lord hath looked upon my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. And then we look at Simon. One of the three meanings is listening. Because the Lord hath heard that I was hated, he hath therefore given me this son also. Then we look at Levi, which means attached or pledged or united as one. Now this time will my husband be joined unto me, because I have borne him three sons. And then finally the sixth son, Zebulun, meaning habitation. God hath endued me with a good dowry. Now will my husband dwell with me, because I have borne him six sons. You could just hear Leah's pain in all this. I mean, this is a tragedy. And this is, like I said, the longest example of polygamy in detail recorded. And there's one other law about polygamy that I'm noting. Deuteronomy 21:15-17. If a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength. And again, it's like each one of these laws is dealing with evils and that of polygamy. None of these are showing any encouragement for polygamy. Again, examples aren't permissions, but they can be warnings. Now here's a challenge. Can anyone name one example in the Bible which shows a polygamous marriage that is good? The closest I've been able to come is is in Genesis 4:23-24, and you don't really learn anything except the names of the two wives and that their husband killed a man and declared that he'd basically get away with it. So we don't really learn any details about the relationship, and that's the closest I can come to a positive thing, is where we don't know anything wrong that happened. And it's about a guy who's a murderer and a polygamist. This is the first recording of polygamy in the Bible. And the only explanation I can come from that this is even in here for is that it's showing how bad things are getting before we have Noah's flood. So, no good examples. Now, Jesus had turned to the establishment of marriage to teach about divorce. He had turned to Genesis. If we do the same, what are we going to see? So we'll go back to Mark 10, but this time, we will go back to Mark 10. Sorry, jumped ahead of myself. Looking at Genesis 2:23-24. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." So you look at the first bit of that. And a man leaves his parents to marry a woman. And a couple principles we can get from that. One principle, adults marry, not children. Another principle, marriages are heterosexual. So these aren't things that got invented later. But the other thing we get away from it, singular man gets a singular wife and they become one flesh. And Mark 10, which looks back on this passage, makes it even more clear. Just focusing on 7-8. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So then they are no more twain, but one flesh. Twain, so two shall be one. And that's how Jesus read that passage. And he interpreted it for divorce, and I think it's pretty clear that it's not polygamy. It's two become one. So this lesson really went a whole lot faster than I think I rushed through it. But we do also have the church standards. If you're interested in reading them this afternoon, the larger catechism, it's under question 139, and the confession is 24:1.